Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America has lost a national treasure. Writer and literary icon Hunter S. Thompson, author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and much more, is dead at age 67. Tonight on Point, Going Gonzo, the legacy of Hunter S. Thompson. But first, we begin in Brussels, Belgium, where President Bush began his visit to Europe on what is being seen as a fence-mending tour. Today, he spoke of strengthening U.S. and EU ties in a speech to some 300 European officials and dignitaries at the ornately gilded Concert Noble Hall. In his speech, the president embraced Europe as a partner rather than a rival, and later dined with French President Jacques Chirac.
This is my first dinner since I've been reelected on European soil, and it's with Jacques Chirac. And that ought to say something. It ought to say how important this relationship is for me personally and how important this relationship is for my country.
Richard Wolff is the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, traveling with the president. I asked him to describe the 19th century concert hall where President Bush delivered his speech earlier today.
It was a gilded room with huge glass chandeliers. There was classical music wafting through the crowd of intellectuals before he came in. I mean, this was not a setting that you would ever have put George W. Bush in. And, you know, I've been covering him for a long time. Listen, he gave a speech that ended with a quote from Albert Camus, the famous existential novelist and philosopher. A totally unexpected setting and a tone which, even for those of us who cover President Bush, was unfamiliar.
Tell us a little bit about what the speech contained in terms of highlights. Certainly some tough words about Russia's crackdown on dissent and rollback of democratic reforms there.
Yeah, he was unusually direct. Remember, this is a president who has said that he likes to deal with President Putin in a private way, asking him why he's taken the decisions he's made. Here he was talking about democracy in Russia, not talking about the external affairs of Russia, its involvement in, for instance, Ukraine, but the internal politics of Russia, and which has raised a lot of concern. But that's not something you've heard a lot of from the administration, and certainly not from the president. So he was very direct there, talking about how important democracy was for Russia itself. This is something of a break. Remember, of course, this is a president who looked into the eyes of President Putin and saw his soul back in 2001.
Also, some interesting things to say about American policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, there were a number of things that were interesting about the Middle East. For a start, the positioning of the Middle East section on the speech, it was the very first thing he really got into after his preamble, the first issue of substance, which tells you a lot about how important Middle East to a European audience and how the administration is recognizing that. It was a very balanced passage on the Middle East, balanced in the sense that what Europeans really care about is how much pressure the administration is going to put on the Israeli government. And in particular, what was noticeable was the insistence on there being a viable Palestinian state. He's used the word viable before, but he said that a state that was divided up into small portions was not acceptable. That's very important because that gets to the heart of where the barrier goes and what Sharon's policy is, Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister's policy is, towards having a real Palestinian state as a neighbor.
And also very emphatic about Syria withdrawing troops from Lebanon.
Yeah, now that's less controversial in a sense. In many ways, the reason he was talking about Lebanon and Syria is because he's underscoring how he's already worked with Jacques Chirac. He's worked with the French to come up with a strong resolution at the United Nations demanding a Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon. This is an area where the president is already working with Europeans. But yes, it's direct about Syria. It's not quite as sort of threatening a situation as Iran, but it's an important marker for how he wants to work with Europe.
And Richard, we're told that in advance, White House officials had been promoting this speech as a major embrace of European unity. And yet, when you look at the text, there were really only a few sentences about that.
Yeah, what he was doing here was using the code words to sort of light the flame in European hearts. He talked about wanting a strong Europe, which for Europeans sounds like he's endorsing the European project of a closer integration, of perhaps things like a European defense policy. Now, behind the scenes, administration officials are saying that's not what they're endorsing. So they're trying to have it both ways by using these code words. I mean, you think about it, taking a step back, the president is never going to come out and say he wants a weak Europe, but simply saying he wants a strong Europe was taken as a very encouraging moment for the Europeans themselves, and that in itself is important.
And was it also significant that the Prime Minister of Belgium spoke about some of the failures of a divided Europe as he was introducing President Bush?
Well, that was significant, but actually the Prime Minister of Belgium, while he recognized Europe's failures on when it came to things like Bosnia, that needed American leadership for anything to be really done, he used that example to say this is why we need a much more united Europe. The European project is still controversial. The voting for an EU constitution is getting a lukewarm reception at best. In some countries, there's downright hostility to a stronger Europe in terms of a more united European Union. So the Prime Minister of Belgium was actually had his foot in both camps. And incidentally, he also made a fairly impassioned plea for engagement with other countries. When he talked, for instance, about the Cold War, he talked about things like the Helsinki Accords. That's a process of engagement with the former communist bloc. And when you look at Iran, that's a very different path from what the administration is pursuing now, much more confrontational from the Washington perspective.
And remind us again, what's he going to be doing there over the next couple of days?
He's got a number of sessions. For a start, he's having breakfast with the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, tomorrow morning. And he's also seeing the Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi. He's going to NATO headquarters and to the European Union headquarters. So it's a very heavy schedule tomorrow, but a lot of sort of pressing the flesh. This is as much about being here as it is what the president says.
Richard Wolff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Brussels. Tonight, the literary world mourns the death of Hunter Thompson. He died of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound at his Colorado home on Sunday. Thompson was one of the most legendary writers of the 20th century, best known for his 1972 classic, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He became a cult figure, and the mythology surrounding him became larger than life. That didn't always sit well with Thompson, as he said in this 1978 interview.
So I'm really in the way as a person. The myth has taken over, and I find myself, an appendage. It would be much better if I died. Then people could take the myth and make films. But I have no choice. I have to solve this problem. So I suppose that my plans are to figure out some new identity. I have to kill off one life and start another one.
Regardless, Hunter S. Thompson was larger than life in every way. He rode with the Hells Angels. He rejected the idea that reporters should stay on the margins looking in. He became part of the stories he covered. He called it gonzo journalism, and not everyone approved. But through his frequent drug and alcohol-induced hazes, Hunter S. Thompson saw big truths about politics, about values, about how we live our lives in this country, about how we keep messing up. What do you remember about the first time you read Hunter Thompson? Did he sound like a fresh new voice, or were you left scratching your head? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington is Lauren Jenkins, senior foreign editor for NPR, a longtime friend of Hunter Thompson who just saw him last Thursday. Lauren, welcome, and sorry for your loss. I imagine this came as a surprise. What can you tell us about the meeting that you had with Thompson on Thursday?
Well, it's a shock. Obviously, Hunter's death is both a personal tragedy to me and all of his other friends, as well as it is, I think, a great loss to American letters. He was a really unique literary figure. I think his I like to think of him as sort of Mark Twain on acid. He's sort of the Mark Twain of the last, of certainly our generation, or my generation, those of us who came of age in the 60s and 70s. He was a voice, fresh, angry, always humorous, irrelevant, you know, irreverent, amusing in every which way. My last meeting with him was last Thursday. I was in Aspen, and as always, I go and we visit and sit around and talk and all that. He was very sober, a bit maudlin. In retrospect, obviously, he was more depressed than I thought. But we had a long conversation about the state of the nation and his own sense that everything he had campaigned for and hoped for, and that was behind his writings. The search for the real American dream and making America freer and more open society than it was, he felt had been negated by the political currents of today, the conservatism of the political system, the rise of corporate power in politics, the loss of one man, one vote, and all those things. And he was very quiet and maudlin about it. It's sort of a feeling that, basically he and those who had supported him and believed in him and believed in the same values had lost out and were now being marginated in the society, squeezed out as a new form of social political puritanism swept the country.
Lawrence, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back to talk more about Hunter Thompson, his colorful life, and his literary legacy. What's your favorite reading from the godfather of gonzo journalism? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Hunter Thompson, the gonzo journalist, dead at age 67. In this BBC documentary from the late 1970s, Thompson said he wasn't nearly as unorthodox as many people thought.
Most people are surprised that I walk on two legs. And the idea that I would have a wife or a child, or I think I said this, even a mother, it seems to surprise me. I think people think I'm very much maybe a violent version of that comic strip.
But those cartoon-like qualities also served to inspire his longtime relationship with British artist Ralph Steadman, who illustrated many of Thompson's works. Here, Steadman explains.
I think what he saw in this our connection was somebody that somehow saw the things in pictures as he saw it in words, you know. And that seemed to me to be part of the whole chemistry of it, that our chemistry there made gonzo possible.
And so we turn to you to ask, what truths did Hunter Thompson reveal to you, and how are you remembering him tonight? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Lauren Jenkins, senior foreign editor at NPR, a longtime friend of Hunter S. Thompson. Lauren, Thompson clearly had this incredibly powerful public image. I wonder if that image was the same as the person you knew.
No, not at all. I think that's part of it. That part of gonzo journalism was to create the character that is gonzo and is Hunter and all of his writings as he personally intrudes on all stories and sees things from a very personal, subjective way. But in private, among friends, he was, he was a Southern gentleman. He came from Kentucky, and he had a charm, a twinkle in his eye, a wry sense of humor. He was thoughtful, always loyal to his friends, generous person. Quite amazing, he was, when you got him in private, he was always sharp intellect, a very committed person, very caring.
Do you have a favorite Thompson story? I mean, when you think about your friend Hunter Thompson, is there a story that you can tell us?
there's so many stories. I mean, he and I, I first met him. I was just getting out of the Peace Corps, and he was on his way to San Francisco. We met in Aspen in a bookstore back in the early 60s and sort of struck up a friendship there, and he went off to ride with the Hells Angels, and I went off to, as I later became, a journalist. And so we met in many places covering stories, Grenada, Vietnam, obviously a lot of places here in the States. One of my favorite stories is in Vietnam. I was the Newsweek bureau chief at the last days of the war there. And as the North Vietnamese were advancing on Saigon, and it was all chaos, and we were all wondering, what are we going to do? How are we going to get out? What point do you pull the plug? In the last couple of weeks, all of a sudden I get a call from Hunter, and he says, he's in Aspen. He says, I'm going to come out and cover the fall of Saigon. And, what can you tell me about it? So I said, hey, this is real fear and loathing. Come on out. We're here. Love to see you. And so he flew to Hong Kong and went to my office there and called me again. And I said, look, we don't know what's going to happen here. I've got a lot of local staff. We may have to buy boats. Newsweek is sending a ton of money. Would you bring it in, hand carry it, into Saigon when he fly in? And I think it was something like $20,000 in cash that he was bringing into the Newsweek bureau. And I said, don't carry it in a satchel. Just sort of tape it to your body. And so I've come back from covering a story up the front one day, and then the hotel keeper at the old Continental Palace is Maître Laurent. He was French Corsican, of course, and he said, there's a strange friend, somebody who says he's your friend who's been coming here and wanting a hotel room. And I said, there were none. But I think he's a CIA agent. I said, what do you mean you think he's a CIA agent? I don't know any CIA agents. And he said, there's this guy, he's wearing, Bermuda shorts, and he has a Hawaiian shirt and a long cigarette holder. And Hunter had been walking up and down the streets, and everyone was figuring only a CIA agent would dress that way. So he sort of, that was sort of Hunter. He came in with $20,000 strapped under his Hawaiian shirt, saying, if this is real fear and loathing.
I should say. Well, Lawrence, stay with us on the line. I want to bring John Pauley into the conversation now. He's a professor of communication at St. Louis University and also the author of the forthcoming book about the new journalism, The Unexpected Triumph of the Long-Form Narrative. John, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And let's expand a little bit on this notion that a journalist should tell it as they see it. Is that a better approach, or does it take someone like a Hunter Thompson to pull it off? Because, of course, the old school of reporting said nothing is made up. You have to be completely objective. You stand back. You observe. You do not inject yourself into the story.
Yes, this is always a dilemma for journalists, because by the very nature of journalism, the reporter is there covering some kind of an event, and the event becomes important because the reporter is there to cover it. And so more conventional objective journalism struggles with this, about how to be there and yet to recognize that one's presence there makes a difference. And I think what we hear in Hunter Thompson is just a willingness to give himself over to the event and to cover it in the way that it happens, and to make visible a lot of the behind-the-scenes details that never show up in other journalists' stories.
It was interesting this morning. The New York Times put up a readers' forum to comment on Thompson's passing, and I was struck by how many people posted how they felt reading him for the first time, about how funny he was, and also this kind of notion of, oh my gosh, can you really say that in public print?
Yeah, he like a number of the other new journalists, were trying to push the edge a little bit in the 1960s and 70s. By our standards today, it doesn't necessarily seem as outrageous, but it did back then, and it did in comparison to what people would consider more normal forms of journalism.
Well, if you were trying to define the term gonzo, how would you define it?
Well, that was like a one-man movement.
It was his alone.
so I think it was I think there was this kind of a sense of free-spiritedness and recklessness. I think he's a wonderful satirist and one of the best satirists of the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, for example, how is his approach different from, let's say, a Tom Wolfe or a Gay Talese?
I think that Wolfe and Talese came a little bit more from newspaper backgrounds, and still when you get underneath them, there's an attempt to explain what's actually happening, very often putting it in some kind of social or historical context. And there's some of that in Thompson. If you go back to Hell's Angels, there's really a lot of sociology in Thompson and trying to figure out what created the Hell's Angels. But I think there's more playfulness in Thompson than in a lot of other writers. And so I think, you know, Lauren Jenkins' comment about the persona was well taken, that he decides to create his own character and then just to immerse himself in one situation after another with comic consequences.
Well, Lauren, I want to put that question to you about Hunter's legacy. Was he bemused or delighted or something else entirely about how he helped transform how journalists did their work in the 60s and 70s and beyond?
Well, I don't think he felt that he had transformed journalism in any way. I think he felt he'd found his own voice, and he was obviously pleased to have had the reception and the readership he had and the following, but I don't think he had any illusions that he created a new form of journalism, but that everyone was going to follow his path. I think he was depressed that more journalists didn't take more chances and challenged the perceived wisdom of government and corporate America more and with greater emphasis than they do, but I don't think he felt he'd really transformed journalism. He knew he'd created his own form of journalism that worked for him.
In other forms, though, I wonder, could there have been a Michael Moore without a Hunter Thompson?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, you know, Michael Moore works in a different medium, and yeah, you're right. It maybe did open it up. I'm sure he obviously a lot of people have tried to imitate Hunter. I mean, I don't think any of them had the intellect or the command of language that he had, which was quite extraordinary. I think, I mean, you read sort of, you know, sentences he wrote, the wit and the savage rapier approach to people and scenes. It's remarkable. And, you know, he's a rare talent. Not everyone can do that. Very few people can.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much. We know you have to go, but thanks for being with us and for adding your memories of Hunter Thompson.
You're welcome. All right.
I want to bring in Larry Kramer to the conversation now. He is the founder of MarketWatch and an executive at Dow Jones. And from 1986 to 88, he was Hunter Thompson's editor at the San Francisco Examiner. Welcome to you, Larry.
Thanks, Gail. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I have to wonder, when you began as Hunter Thompson's editor, did you have some trepidation about what that was going to be like?
I had no clue what it was going to be like.
So what was it like?
I knew it was, I mean, there had been a lot. By that time, he had gone through many of his famous magazine escapades, but nobody had really tried to put him in the paper with any degree of frequency. And that was our challenge, and he rose to it, although he took every inch he could.
Did you ever have to approve one of his expense reports?
Many times.
and was that an exercise in creative writing?
Yes. Well, I mean, most of the hard parts of his expense accounts came through not because he submitted them. we had a hotel in San Francisco send over a bill for a three-day stay that was $2,400, which was pretty high, and this was kind of a dump, and it was pretty high for the 80s when this was. And when we pressed them for a detailed bill, because all it said was, you know, Hunter Thompson room, 3 days, $2,400, we pressed on about it, and it turned out it had something to do with an ice machine on the floor that had been knocked over and shot.
And shot?
Yeah, so there was a bullet hole in it. And so we had, it was always something different.
Yes, unexpected. Well, I'm going to put a question to you and then to John Pauly about what his style of writing taught us that perhaps we might not have gotten otherwise. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, he had a wonderful style. He had a liberal use of adjectives and verbs, but he also was, you know, he did inject himself into the story, and he in many ways made the stories very personal. And his, you know, what was so wonderful was, you know, he just gave you the sense he wasn't pulling a single punch. If there's anything, if he really wanted to say somebody was nasty, he found more ways to say nasty, in many ways nastier than the word nasty. And just you had to laugh because he made his point so sharply. It was terrific. Plus, you know, he took every corner he could, and he basically took no prisoners. I mean, there was nobody who escaped some degree of his acidity, including us. You know, when he would complain about a word being cut or something, the names he would call us in memos, and actually there were faxes at the time mostly, were extraordinary. And we all finally, after the first few times, just began to chuckle a little bit because it was wonderful.
And John, I want to go to our phone lines in just a second. So can I ask you just for a kind of quick reflection on that point about his writing style and what it gave us?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we don't think of him as a stylist in the same way we might think of a Joan Didion or a Tom Wolfe. I think he was actually a much more careful and accomplished writer than he gives himself credit for. I think a lot of what I remember him for is for the irony and the parody and being kind of hip about the mass media in a way that we now take for granted, but which was more unusual then.
It certainly was. To North Reading, Pennsylvania, we want to go to Tom, who's on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you all this evening?
We're fine, thank you. What was your thought about Hunter Thompson?
Well, I had just listened to Ralph Steadman responding to a question about what was gonzo journalism really all about. And I thought there was a great tie into one of Hunter's earlier pieces before he'd even gotten the concept of gonzo journalism. And that would be from his, I believe it was in 1965, Hell's Angels was published, 65 or 66.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a tender teenager at that time, just got my driver's license, had a hot new motorcycle myself, and one of my friends said, gee, you got to read this guy's book, particularly his all about riding with the Hells Angels. Well, not very long after I got a hold of the book and before I'd gotten to the section in question, I had my own motorcycle accident. So I found out myself where the edge was. And the edge is the key to Hunter's work.
Hmm.
Hunter always managed to explore the edge. I do believe a few times he actually went over it and managed to get back in one piece.
He did indeed. Tom, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Greenville, Rhode Island now. Dave's on the line. Hello, Dave.
Hello. I just wanted to mention my introduction to Hunter Thompson, which was it was back in the early 70s, and I was considering getting into journalism, becoming a journalist, but found that journalism was incredibly boring until I discovered an article called The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, which I believe I found in a book called The New Journalism. I don't know if it's was written by Mr. Pauly or not.
And actually, we're going to have an excerpt from that, Dave, at the end of the program, so you'll definitely want to stay with us for that.
Excellent. Excellent. And also, I wanted to mention that someone suggested a correlation between Michael Moore and Hunter Thompson. I think a more accurate one today might be John Stewart and Hunter Thompson.
Hmm. Interesting thought, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us. Let me put that question to you, Larry Kramer. Who would you see as the next generation to whom Thompson passed the baton?
Well, you know, Stewart's an interesting idea there because within his medium. Problem is I don't see it in the writers. You know, we don't have people. Hunter was an incredibly efficient writer. I mean, he wrote really tightly, and he could pack a lot into a short column or a short chapter. And that I haven't seen that kind of writing skill really emerge from a lot of people who are being published today, who are at least getting themselves published. Now, maybe it's harder to get published, but he managed to take it to sports, to politics, to a number of areas. And so I think it's going to be very hard to do that. But I think in the broadcast world and in the new worlds of blogging and where a lot more people are out there taking chances, you'll find people who are starting to develop a little bit of character like that. And I think Stewart's a great example.
Larry Kramer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Larry Kramer, from 1986 to 88, was Hunter Thompson's editor at the San Francisco Examiner. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to say more about the colorful life and now legacy of Hunter S. Thompson. What is his legacy? Do you remember the first time you read him, and what did you think? Did you get it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
There was only one road back to L.A., U.S. Interstate 15. Just a flat-out high-speed burn through Baker and Barstow and Purdue. Then onto the Hollywood freeway, straight into frantic oblivion. Safety. Obscurity. Just another freak. In the freak kingdom.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and I just wanted to mention that as we took that break a couple of moments ago, what you heard was a bit from the 1998 film Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Johnny Depp played Hunter S. Thompson, and that's who we're talking about this hour. His life and work, the gonzo journalist, dead at age 67. In this reflection from a 1978 BBC documentary, Thompson speaks about the irony that the America he lays bare in his writings is the only country that would allow a person like himself to flourish.
Obviously, one of the things I have to think, I have to appreciate about America. If I didn't, I'd be stupid or insane, is that for good or ill, I can function here. And I don't think that there are many societies or social political systems where I could function the way I am now. And perhaps a lot of people would think it's much better. You know, that's the best argument for destroying the system, that it gets rid of people like me.
Again, that was Hunter S. Thompson in 1978. So 10 years, 25 years from now, how will Hunter Thompson be remembered by the next generation? Was he a breath of fresh air on the literary scene? What truths did he reveal? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with us this hour is John Pauley, professor of communication at St. Louis University, also author of the forthcoming book, The New Journalism, The Unexpected Triumph of the Long-Form Narrative. And right now, I also want to bring into the conversation from New York, Eric Gillen. He's an editor of The Black Table, which is a pop culture website. He met Hunter Thompson in the summer of 2000 at his home in Woody Creek, Colorado. Welcome, Eric, and tell us that story. How in the world did you manage to, A, get Thompson's phone number, and, B, get a meeting with him?
Well, it was the summer of 2000. That was during the dot-com boom. And they gave a couple of crazy 24-year-olds enough money to launch a website about politics and young people. And we decided, like any young people with corporate backing, that we would have to drive cross-country. So we left from Philadelphia, covered the convention, and drove to L.A., and on the way, we decided that it would be a good idea to maybe interview Hunter S. Thompson, as somebody who was a huge influence in my career and pretty much everyone that was doing journalism where we were working. I actually got his number from Peter Lawford, the Kennedy, the son of Chris Lawford, the son of Peter Lawford and the Kennedys, and I got the phone number and actually called up Hunter at home.
And
I
understand that you came bearing gifts at his insistence, but why did he want explosives?
You know, Hunter wanted 24 pounds of explosives. He wanted these, they were called rocket flares, and they were used parachute flares in the harbor when you were 3 miles away if you were lost at sea so the planes could see you. And I have no idea why he wanted the flares, but when we got to Woody Creek, he ripped open that can like it was Christmas and started waving these flares around the house. And he opened the drawers in his kitchen. He's got speed loaders and bullets and guns and everything all over the apartment, all over this house.
And you actually stayed for dinner, I understand. What did you talk about that night?
He had on CNN, and we basically talked about
how unexciting the 2000 election was. It's kind of hard to imagine that now, but at the time, Bush versus Gore wasn't a very thrilling race for anyone. And he was talking about why he didn't want to cover it and why he didn't want to do anything. And he was, you know, not very into it. And he actually handed us his books, and we read to him, like, you know, like it was like sort of a visit at a nursing home. We were reading Hunter S. Thompson's material back to Hunter S. Thompson.
Which I would imagine was a little bit unnerving. Eric Gillen, we have to go, but thank you so much for being with us and sharing that story.
Thanks.
We go now to David McCumber, managing editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer from 1985 to 87. He was Hunter Thompson's editor at the San Francisco Examiner and also served as editor of two of Thompson's books, Generation of Swine and The Songs of the Doomed. Thompson dedicated both books to him. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us your favorite Hunter Thompson story.
Oh, boy, there's so many, but let's see. One day, Hunter was having difficulty with one of his girlfriends. There'd been a rupture in the relationship, shall we say, and Hunter said to me, David, do you believe in love? And I said, well, Hunter, you know I do. Of course I do. And he said, great, do you have a credit card that works? said, yes. And he said, great, I want to send Maria some roses. And I thought, well, sure, that's great. Hunter proceeded to send 100 dozen roses on my American Express card to his girlfriend. The good news is that 100 dozen roses works. She flew to his side, but it was quite an experience.
And did he ever reimburse you?
He certainly did.
Oh, good. Well, I'm happy to hear that. One of the comments I heard earlier today about him, this story was told by Bruce Morton, who was out there covering politics at the same time Hunter Thompson was.
Yeah.
And Morton made the point that Hunter was very good about never letting the facts get in the way of a good story.
Well, that's a very good way of saying it. Frankly, Hunter usually saw the best angle in those good stories, and he would absolutely revel in that angle, and he would tell it in the most entertaining way. The editing his column was great because you never knew from one week to the next whether you're going to get sort of demented, humorous prose, or whether you were going to get hard-eyed political analysis. But whatever you got, it was good, and it was fun, and it was after deadline.
Well, was it frustrating ever?
Actually, it was. I was too busy to be frustrated. Mm-hmm. It was just great fun, and quite rewarding. I mean, everybody assumed that the column would last 3 weeks when Hunter agreed to start it, and it ended up lasting 5 years, and the work was terrific. There was a circulation spike on the day his column ran. The readers loved him, and it was quite an experience.
Thank you so much, David McCumber, for being with us. We want to go back to our phone lines to Medford, Massachusetts. Martha's on the line. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
Welcome to the program. What was the point you wanted to make?
Well, I feel like a real wet blanket on this party, and it's also very strange to be calling in as a conservative to your show, because usually I'm quite in there with agreeing with you. But I'm a mother of a teenager who thinks that Hunter Thompson is just great, and I just see drugs. I see drugs. I see guns. I see, you know, think for yourself and don't care about what the legal things are. And I'm glad to hear from your show that there's a lot more that's thoughtful and sensitive and gentle and all those generous and all those things about him. But this kind of hero worship of somebody who's really living a wild and risky lifestyle, there's got to be some kind of, you know, I don't have to ruin the whole party, but a little bit of realism, or I don't know what. I mean, if you were the mother of a son who thought he was so great. So that's my concern.
Okay, Martha, let's put that question to David McCumber. David, what would you say to Martha?
Well, I guess I would say Hunter was always careful to say, don't try this at home. Of course, how effective that admonition was is unclear, but certainly he has remained he remained appealing to generations of young people. And I think along with, you know, the drugs and the booze came some pretty good messages about participation in the political system and caring about the morality of your government. And, you know, so it's definitely definitely a mixed bag. As a parent, I understand and empathize, but I also think there was an awful lot to admire in his work.
And John Pauley, I wonder what your response to that would be.
I think it's important to distinguish between the man and the persona. And so partly it's taking pleasure, you know, the reader's taking pleasure in a kind of story that seems wild. There are few people I've ever known who'd want to live the way that Hunter Thompson lived. When he was at Rolling Stone, because so many of the readers were appreciative that they would send in drugs to the magazine to reward them for doing such good work. And Hunter Thompson was the local drug tester. Whatever people sent in, he was willing to try to have the first crack at. And nobody, I don't know many people who want to live that way. I think if I were a conservative, one of the things I would see in Hunter Thompson is a kind of principled libertarianism. Somebody who really respects the individual and thinks that the organizations that we live in have really pinched us.
Well, and let me ask you the question that we posed to our listeners a few moments ago, which is, how do you think we'll view him 5 years out, 10 years out, 25 years out?
I think he'll be a reminder to us of some of the contradictions of journalism as a profession. It's always interested me that there are a lot of working journalists who have a secret love for Hunter Thompson stuff, and it's a kind of work that's totally different from the work that they do in news organizations. And so, I think he'll be remembered as a really sharp analyst in some ways of professional journalism, and I think he'll also be there'll be that satirical voice, which I don't think anybody has quite managed.
And David, clearly a personal loss for you as well as a professional one.
Well, yes, it certainly is. I think Hunter will be remembered also as a great American literary voice. I think he'll be remembered with Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken and people like that. His humor and his style is absolutely inimitable, and I think that he's won quite a place in the pantheon.
Well, David, we will say goodbye to you now with many thanks. I did it prematurely a few moments ago, but we're happy you were able to stay with us this long.
Thanks so much.
David McCumber, editor of two of Thompson's books, Generation of Swine and Songs of the Doomed. Also, Eric Gillen joined us from New York. He's editor of The Black Table. Larry Kramer was with us from San Francisco, also a former editor for Hunter Thompson. Lauren Jenkins was with us earlier in the hour from Washington, senior foreign editor at NPR. And John Pauley, thanks to you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
John Pauley is professor of communication at St. Louis University and author of The New Journalism, The Unexpected Triumph of the Long-Form Narrative. We end the hour tonight with a reading from one of Hunter S. Thompson's breakthrough essays titled The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved. That essay was originally published in Scanlon's Monthly in June of 1970. Thompson later said the essay marked the birth of gonzo journalism. In this excerpt, Thompson is in Louisville, Kentucky, covering the Derby weekend, along with British illustrator Ralph Steadman. The passage is read by WBUR's Chris O'Connor.
He had done a few good sketches, but so far we hadn't seen that special kind of face that I felt we would need for a lead drawing. It was a face I'd seen 1,000 times at every Derby I'd ever been to. I saw it in my head as the mask of the whiskey gentry, a pretentious mix of booze, failed dreams, and a terminal identity crisis, the inevitable result of too much inbreeding in a closed and ignorant culture. One of the key genetic rules in breeding dogs, horses, or any other kind of thoroughbred is that the close inbreeding tends to magnify the weak points in a bloodline as well as the strong points. In horse breeding, for instance, there is a definite risk in breeding two fast horses who are both a little crazy. The offspring will likely be very fast and also very crazy. So the trick in breeding thoroughbreds is to retain the good traits and filter out the bad. But the breeding of humans is not so wisely supervised, particularly in a narrow southern society, where the closest kind of inbreeding is not only stylish and acceptable, but far more convenient to the parents than setting their offspring free to find their own mates for their own reasons and in their own ways. So the face I was trying to find in Churchill Downs that weekend was a symbol in my own mind of the whole doomed atavistic culture that makes the Kentucky Derby what it is. On our way back to the motel after Friday's races, I warned Stedman about some of the other problems we'd have to cope with. Neither of us had brought any strange illegal drugs, so we would have to get by on booze. You should keep in mind, I said, that almost everybody you talk to from now on will be drunk. People who seem very pleasant at first might suddenly swing at you for no reason at all. He nodded, staring straight ahead. He seemed to be getting a little numb, and I tried to cheer him up by inviting him to dinner that night with my brother. Back at the motel, we talked for a while about America, the South, England, just relaxing a bit before dinner. There was no way either of us could have known, at the time, that it would be the last normal conversation we would have. From that point on, the weekend became a vicious, drunken nightmare. We both went completely to pieces. The main problem was my prior attachment to Louisville, which naturally led to meetings with old friends, relatives, etc., many of whom were in the process of falling apart, going mad, plotting divorces, cracking up under the strain of terrible debts, or recovering from bad accidents. Right in the middle of the whole frenzied derby action, a member of my own family had to be institutionalized. This added a certain amount of strain to the situation, and since poor Stedman had no choice but to take whatever came his way, he was subjected to shock after shock. Another problem was his habit of sketching people he met in the various social situations I dragged him into, then giving them the sketches. The results were always unfortunate. I warned him several times about letting the subjects see his foul renderings, but for some perverse reason, he kept doing it. Consequently, he was regarded with fear and loathing by nearly everyone who'd seen or even heard about his work. He couldn't understand it. "It's sort of a joke," he kept saying. "Why, in England, it's quite normal. People don't take offense. They understand that I'm just putting them on a bit." "England," I said. "This is Middle America. These people regard what you're doing to them as a brutal, bilious insult. Look what happened last night. I thought my brother was going to tear your head off." Stedman shook his head sadly. "But I liked him. He struck me as a very decent, straightforward sort." "Look, Ralph," I said, "let's not kid ourselves. That was a very horrible drawing you gave him. It was the face of a monster. It got on his nerves very badly." I shrugged. "Why in the hell do you think we left the restaurant so fast?" "I thought it was because of the mace," he said.
"What mace?"
He grinned. "When you shot it at the head waiter, don't you remember?"
"Hell, that was nothing," I said. "I missed him, and we were leaving anyway."
An excerpt from Hunter S. Thompson's 1970 essay, The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved, read by WBUR's Chris O'Connor. Back in 1978, during the filming of a BBC documentary, Thompson said he wanted no funeral services when he died. All he wanted was one song. So we'll close tonight with that song, Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is every 2 years the doctor tells me I'm going to die. For all I know, I might somehow live for 10 more years.
Well, that's something, none of us know how long we're going to live.
No, I provided for no ceremony except for one song. That's Mr. Tambourine Man.
And take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and...
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.